Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm going to be your Columbo today, and because we're looking at artworks, there is always just one more thing, sir, to explore. With this podcast series, you will have the images available embedded into the podcast in high definition, so just click on the link. But if you can't access it that way, I'll give you the title of the work we're going to be looking at, and you can put it into your search engine and bring up the image in front of you while you talk. So I am joined in my investigations today by Lars Tharp, dear friend, and you actually have the title of Hogarth Curator, I believe, Lars.
I do. I was a director at the Foundling Museum in London, where William Hogarth was himself a governor when it was still a hospital for foundlings. And now I'm its ambassador. I rejoice in the title of Hogarth Curator.
Hogarth Curator, what a title. And who better, therefore, to look at an image that's really fascinated me for a long time. Hogarth's Gin Lane. Date, 1751.
Yeah.
And I'll give a bit of background. We've got the dimensions. It is about 35 centimetres by about 30 centimetres. It's an etching and engraving on paper. And as I said, if you want to look at the image along with us, type Gin Lane Hogarth into the search engine and it should come up in front of you. It is a fascinating image, I think, for me, because it is just, to me, very grisly.
Yeah, it is. And it's a good example of Hogarth's moralizing. He started off in the early 1730s creating narrative series in paint and in print. And even in 1751, he was very, very concerned about the state of London. It was getting more and more violent. His friend Henry Fielding, who was a magistrate, had already written about how bad the violence was getting. And everybody was pointing the finger, surprise, surprise, at the crack cocaine of its day. And that was gin.
Yeah, yeah. And gin is a serious problem, isn't it, at this stage? I mean, we're not talking about your nice Bombay Sapphire, are we?
Well, the gin that you make a gin and tonic with is essentially, yes, it is the same thing. But of course, very few people, apart from some of my friends, drink neat gin. In the 18th century, it was a neat drink. It was like almost like a liqueur, really, quite oily, very alcoholic. And as we see in the print, the seller that's in the bottom left-hand corner advertising the fact that gin is being sold there says over the door, drunk for a penny, dead drunk for tuppence, and good free straw for nowt. And that was about it. You know, if you were very, very poor and living in London in the 1740s, 50s, gin was an anaesthetic because life was so pretty grim. That gin was one way of escaping from it.
Yes, the account is it's copulation and alcohol are the only things to distract the poor at this stage.
Yes, now there's a thought.
But I must say, I'm absolutely delighted as well because we have got in front of us a version of the print. You've got a collection of the prints here. It's so nice to be up close with a proper replica size version of the print.
Yeah.
But this is later, isn't it? This is an 1840 version, did you say?
Well, the whole collection is of prints that have been run off in the early 1800s, yeah. Uh-huh. But the version you see here, which is much darker than the earlier 1751 print, is almost certainly exactly as it appeared when Hogarth reprinted it 8 years later in 1759, because it was still a problem. And Hogarth was issuing these really as a sort of as a social do-gooder. He was trying to show this is how evil, how insidious this drink is. And of course, the companion to this is Beer Street.
Yes, you've got Beer Street over the page. Hear the lovely crack. Oh, the paper turning there. Right. And there is our Beer Street image. Again, very very dark, much darker than the 51 version. But a more positive scene. I want to think about Gin Lane in particular to begin with, because I think that what's going on there tells us an awful lot about London at the time, the problems that were taking place. Hogarth creates these prints as a pair, doesn't he? And he wants they come after a series of moralising prints that he's been developing from paintings. At what point in his career does he do these then?
Well, he was born in 1697 and he starts off as an apprentice silver engraver because of family circumstances. But he clearly is not happy doing that. He's got, you know, he's driven by talent, and he takes up night classes with James Thornhill. He elopes with James Thornhill's daughter. by this time, he's starting to paint in the late 1720s. And very quickly in 1732, he creates his first, what he calls modern moral subject, the Harlot's Progress.
Now, am I right in thinking he develops sequential art? This was something I read. So he's basically the godfather of comic books.
Well, not only, Janina, of comic books, but of television and film.
Oh, yes, of course.
I mean, you know, it's no accident that on the site of his studio in Leicester Square, today we have a cinema.
Wow, that's perfect, isn't it? That's perfect. But it's that fascinated me. And of course, we see these narratives in art, Western art, before Hogarth, that he really designs these sequences that are to be read in order, that tell you a whole story. So the Rake's Progress, the Harlot's Progress, those sets, they take you from sort of the downfall right the way through to the death and destruction.
Yes, well, in the case of the Harlot, 1732, you've got a young lady, a young woman arriving from York on the York stage.
I didn't know she was from York.
She was from York. I hate to say it. It's well known for supplying young ladies.
For young harlots.
And she arrives on the stage. She's intercepted by a madam who's already pocked, you know, she should have seen the signs there. And she's installed with a sugar daddy who looks after her, but she is obviously not getting enough from him. So she takes a young lover, and that's the beginning of the fall. She kicks over the table with posh porcelain on it. That's what got me interested many, many years ago. And she then, the decline starts from that moment on. You know, the falling table is a pre-echo of the fall of the harlot. And it goes through a series of total six images. And at the end, there she is lying in her coffin. That was Hogarth's debut as a, if you like, a narrative series creator. He painted it first. Mm. And because he trained as a silver engraver, he then engraves it. And thereby, and this is the real revolution, because he's got the skills to engrave. Whereas an artist would have to have sold all of the painting, then get painting again, Sonny. But because he's running off, I think, 1,000 versions of Harlot, he makes £1,000. So that he's able now, from now on, from 1732 on, he is able to sustain himself and his new wife because he's got an income. And that is really the rest of the story of Hogarth, right up until his death in 1764. He is an independent artist who can do what he wants, who can visualize London as he sees it, and to entertain and moralise at the same time. It's a very interesting balancing act. Mm. He goes then to Rake's Progress in 1735. He consolidates his earnings by getting the Hogarth Act, the first Copyright Act, passed through.
Yes, that's interesting, isn't it? It's the first Copyright Act for artists.
That's correct.
And for visual material in general, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it guarantees what had been with the Harlot's Progress. You've got pirates down the road who, the moment what they bought one set of prints, they'd be out there re-engraving their own version. And there was nothing to stop people doing that. And Hogarth and other artists got together and said, no, we must stop this because there is already a Copyright Act for texts. We must do the same for artists. And that really consolidates this, the first modern artist in England and arguably probably in the world.
Yeah, he's a real trailblazer in terms of being able to convert his art to money through the printmaking, because this is the rise of the print, isn't it? This is the period where we really see a hunger for this sort of printed material throughout society. Art is no longer simply the preserve of the super wealthy.
No.
Everybody can have a bit. And I mean, I was intrigued. He was a member of the Rose and Crown Club, which, yes, this was fascinating. I was doing a bit of reading. So you've got Tilleman, William Kent, Risback, these are these big names. And Hogarth was one of them. And of course, this connection with Freemasonry as well. So I was intrigued about this idea of artists pulling together, having a greater connection across the mediums, so between paint and sculpture and architecture and print, but also this idea of trying to bring about social change, because he also interacts with authors, doesn't he? And when we get to Gin Lane, this is not just an image. This is not just an artwork. This is something that's part of social transformation, isn't it?
Yeah. His great decade for painting, just to sort of see where the phases of his life, comes in 1745 with Marriage à la Mode. Mm. That is another modern moral subject. It's a couple getting married. He's got title, she's got money, and the whole story is how the whole thing goes very badly wrong. By then, Hogarth is already involved with the Foundling Hospital.
Right. Give a bit of context on the Foundling Hospital. Then.
Well, let's just in the late 1730s, William Hogarth volunteers to paint the two great walls on the grand staircase of St. Bart's Hospital free, because he cannot bear the thought that the hospital trustees are going to give the job to an Italian and pay him, So Hogarth says, I'll do this for free, which gives you some idea of how reasonably well off he must have been to do this. These are huge, these canvases. So he's already involved in charitable works. That's the important thing. And at some stage around that time, he must have got to know Thomas Coram, the great saint of English charity, an amazing fellow. And Coram is trying to set up England's first home for abandoned babies, or babies at risk of being abandoned, foundlings.
And this is a serious problem, isn't it? Because there are many, many children that are being abandoned at this stage. Yeah.
London is growing. I mean, it goes from 500,000 in 1700 to 1 million by the end of the century. Young women are being abandoned in the natural course of things. I mean, young men are being press-ganged into the Navy. So the sorts of social ties that you would have expected them to have enjoyed in more rural communities, as London becomes a cosmopolitan, anonymous city, women are the victims. They are abandoned by men for various reasons. And they are having a child or being pregnant is almost a death sentence, both for the woman and the child. So Coram, who spots these bodies of babies abandoned in the street, says that we've got to do something about this. And it takes him 17 and a half years. He records the half, to succeed. And by the end, he's got Hogarth on board. Hogarth devises the subscription form for people to donate to this charity, this new charity. But above all, Hogarth, and we shouldn't ignore this, Hogarth is a great portraitist.
Yes.
And Hogarth says, okay, Thomas, you're going to have a lot of walls in this new institution. Let's have some art. Mm. And I will paint you a cracking portrait of you. So Hogarth paints a full-length portrait of Thomas Coram.
Oh, it is a cracker, isn't it?
It is the greatest portrait of an Englishman by an Englishman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it's a wonderful portrait. Go and see it. Those of you who are listening who haven't been there, the Foundling Museum has that portrait. And stand in front of it and gaze into the eyes of Thomas Coram. And I can guarantee you it'll hold your gaze for a long, long time. Anyway,
there's real benevolence and humanity in the image. But I think what's beautiful as well is this idea that Hogarth wants to improve the lives of these children yes. through art, and yes. he writes about art and beauty, doesn't he? He sees art as something that can fix and improve and make the world better.
Yes. Well, he comes out of a very literary tradition. You know, he just overlaps with Alexander Pope. You know, the moralists are already well ahead of Hogarth in print. Jonathan Swift and so he shows that he has a charitable impulse. He's not just an artist on the make. Mm. He's somebody who's interested in the world about him and is prepared to make statements about it, not just to take the money like Joshua Reynolds does later on. Yes,
not our favourites of the
get the knife into Joshua Reynolds.
He got the knife into Hogarth, didn't he?
So we're getting the revenge. So we see him in getting involved with the hospitals, and this actually does work to Hogarth's own advantage. This is what we would call enlightened self-interest. You're right, absolutely right. He's a Freemason, and of course, through the Freemasonry network, which is also charitably inclined, everybody was a Freemason. Mm. I mean, Freemasonry, although it claims to go back to the Temple of Solomon, was a relatively new thing in London. 1720s is really when it starts. So Hogarth is there in the first wave. His father-in-law, Sir James Thornhill, is a Freemason. All the people, all the males he paints are Freemasons.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, more or less. Yeah. I mean, you know, anybody who was anybody in London in the 1740s. And of course, they are the people who eventually become signatories to the Foundling Hospital. Yeah. So by helping Thomas Coram out to create this much-needed institution, Hogarth, by the way, creates his own personal art gallery. Mm. He tells all of his chums in the painting fraternity, we've got an art gallery, because there has been no public art gallery in London until then. And the charity benefits, because it draws people in to come and see the art. It draws them in to pay. And so that you've got this wonderful parallel of artists helping themselves, but also helping society.
Yes, exactly. I was just thinking this ties us perfectly back into our images, doesn't it? Because at the point when he is making these, they are going to be distributed publicly, aren't they? Now, yeah. Okay, so they cost a shilling each, is that yeah. right? And that's not the sort of thing that everybody is going to be spending their money on, but it certainly does bring it out from the upper classes into the hands of maybe the middle class.
Yes. And Hogarth thought, well, first of all, to put it in context, the average labourer around that time was getting 7 shillings and 6 pence. What's that in? Can you do a quick conversion?
Oh, I can't do it in modern money.
It's about 32 pence or something like that per week.
Yeah.
And Hogarth was thinking, well, if the apprentices can't afford this, which they can't, nevertheless, the masters will.
Exactly. And they could distribute them, discuss the yeah. images. And they are being sold in coffee shops. They're being sold quite widely to people, aren't they? And the intention in this pair of images is to highlight the troubles of gin. And we've yeah. got to put gin in a bit of context here, haven't we? Because there's this relationship with France that is increasingly strained. Wine is no longer being imported and drunk in the quantities it was. So gin is seen as a good English version, and in the run-up to the production of this print, for those decades before, everybody is distilling gin, aren't they? It gets yeah. to the point where 1 in 4 households in certain areas is distilling gin.
It is incredible to look at any statistics. I think the one that springs to mind, I think, is it 1740? They estimate that there were, 7,000 households in London.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And that they are distilling 2.5 million gallons of gin in 1 year. So I made the comparison with crack cocaine. It's actually, the more one thinks about it, the more relevant that is. And Hogarth, in his preface to these prints, he's aiming it at the lower classes. He says that the lower classes is an interesting phrase because, of course, you know, we at that stage we are only talking about the emerging middle classes. So I think Hogarth, but he is certainly not aiming it at the aristocratic classes.
Marriage à la Mode, he's poked fun at the aristocratic class, hasn't he? And this does seem to be a redirection of his work towards the concerns of the poor.
Yeah,
and it's set in St. Giles. It's set in this very rundown part of London where gin was an absolute epidemic. Everybody was affected by it. And as you described earlier on, we're not talking lovely, you know, nice purified gin. This is thick, often mixed up with turps and nasty things. It's dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
And potentially, you know, in this image, you could see how deadly it is. I'm always drawn to the bottom right-hand corner, that skeletal figure that's hunched over on the stairs with the dog, the obligatory Hogarthian dog next to him.
Well, the dog has given up any prospect of food, so he's beginning to nibble the ankle of the woman who's obviously stupefied by drink. She's attempting to take a peck of snuff out of her little snuff box. And in the process, the child that she was looking after is tumbling, well, it to its death or certainly to its injury in the cellar below.
And this isn't all fantasy, is it? Because, you know, that looks horrendous. The way that the woman in the middle drops her baby, totally out of it on gin. She's got syphilitic sores all over her legs. And yes, like you say, she's reaching for some snuff. And it looks like it's something out of a horror. But actually, there was accounts of things like this happening, of children being... There was one, Judith Defoe. In 1734, strangled her child so that she could sell the child's clothes for gin money.
Yeah.
And there's reports all the way through of this sort of treatment of children, mistreatment of children. So you've got infanticide, you've got cannibalism, the sort of suggestion almost of, look at these figures halfway up on the left-hand side, chewing on the leg bone.
Yeah, and the dog.
With a dog.
A dog joining in. And then in the background, the only person who's thriving in this regime is the pawnbroker.
Yeah.
And Hogarth is making quite a serious point here for apprentices, because the pawnbroker is he's holding up a bundle of tools, carpenter's tools, including a saw. And the guys at the door are selling the tools of their trade. The only way they could have made money, and they're willing to sell those very tools. So in other words, it's a no return strategy. They cannot, that once they've gone that far, they've lost any opportunity to pull themselves up.
But that's why everything's dilapidated, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. Everything is falling apart. You've got that building over in the top right, which is actually toppling over. The chimney pots are coming off. That's on the brink of collapse.
Yeah.
And everything's in disarray. You could see just in front of that building that the wall has fallen down. And inside, I think that's the barber's shop, because I think that pole sticking out is the red and white barber's pole. I think that's a barber who's hanged themselves because nobody wants to keep themselves clean anymore.
Well, appropriately, the barber, you can see him hanging there through the dilapidated wall. And the building's door, which is actually falling down, you can see the bricks falling
holds up this coffin shape because that is the Undertaker.
So thriving.
The Undertaker's doing rather well. And if you look on the ground, you can see just over the drunken lady's right shoulder, you can see a female corpse being put into the coffin. Mm. And a man with a cross just doing the last rites. And just above her head, the head of the nurse or the mother, there is a rather jolly looking, I think he must be chimney sweep. He's got bellows in one hand, and then in the other hand, he's got one of the tools of his trade, and he's absolutely oblivious to the fact that a baby, presumably from the dilapidated build, has fallen out of the building
impaled.
As is impaled on his stake.
He has got he looks slightly crazy, doesn't he? And actually, that idea of craziness, madness, yeah, obsesses Hogarth quite a lot as well, doesn't he? Bedlam and the real fear of actually social degradation leading to madness.
Hogarth
and chaos.
Was very well placed to make these observations because not only was he a governor of the Foundling Hospital, but he was also a governor of various other institutions, including Bedlam.
I didn't know he was actually connected to Bedlam. There you go. Okay.
Yeah, going back to Rake's Progress. The final mad scene in Bedlam in the Rake's Progress in number 8 is built on what Hogarth himself would have seen. Mm. I should just say that, you know, as far as Gin Lane is concerned, there is a huge and really quite pointed finger directed to George II.
Yes.
Because this extraordinary structure, it looks like a pyramid, is actually the spire of St. George's Bloomsbury, which, if you pass by it today, you'll see it looks exactly the same. This is not a piece of fantasy. This building exists.
This is the spire just up in the sort of top left-hand middle section there.
Yeah, it's on the horizon, if you like. And the figure on top of that spire is George II. And what has he got above his head? Well, Hogarth is making a point. The pawnbroker's balls are pointing straight down at the monarch, as if to say, this is happening in your time, in your reign. Mm. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, it's on your watch, Buster. Yeah. How are you going to fix this situation? Yeah. Because this is a scene of chaos. And right the way through, I mean, the reason I love Hogarth's paintings and prints is the levels of detail. You could just spend so much time zooming in on particular details. There's a couple of foundlings in this, aren't there? Or at least there's little girls with the badges on their arms, I think, over there. So he's even commenting on that situation. But the whole thing is about the fact that from the very bottom up, people are broken. And the fact they are selling their tools means they're not going to fix it. They're addicted to a highly dangerous alcohol. And this is not the solution. But in The Pear, of course, with Beer Street...
Yeah.
This is proposed to be some sort of a solution, isn't it?
Yeah, solution being the right word.
They're still drinking. They're still boozing.
Well, what you have here is, the prime character here, I think, is the artist.
Oh, yes, the sign painter, yeah.
In the top left-hand corner. Well, sign painter, yes, but Hogarth, I think, is saying here is an artist. Mm. And he's a poor man. His clothes are ragged and he's very thin. You know, he's not been well fed, unlike some of the figures below him.
He's got Hogarth's easel as well, hasn't he?
He's
that
got
famous
the easel.
Sign that he
That's
uses.
Right. And what's he doing? He's ignoring the sign that was on there, which is the little square sign is advertising gin. But it's being superseded by the big sign that he's painting, which is the Barley Mow.
Yes.
He's advertising beer. And across the way, you can see the pawnbroker's balls are already dropping. And below them, there is an altogether much happier scene of rather corpulent gentlemen on the left-hand side drinking. The woman selling herrings, they all look reasonably well to do. And the pawnbroker's shop on the right-hand margin, you can see the pawnbroker is so badly out of business, is reaching through his peephole for a flagon of beer to keep him happy. By the way, in the window above, another delicious little detail, that box is, of course, a rat trap. Because it's still in the up position, it has failed to catch any rats because
the rats have abandoned the ship. There's nothing worth eating.
Gosh,
at the pawnbrokers.
I hadn't even seen the rat trap. Yes, because now this is a scene of plenty, of industry. Look, they're all busy. I mean, they are resting. They're taking a rest, but they're tired from having worked. Yeah. And the things they're doing are trying to rebuild London, aren't they? And you could see that they've put their tools down to have a big pint of beer.
And it's very patriotic because this gentleman here is holding up a leg of beef. And, of course, beef was the sort of signpost of Englishness.
Le roast beef.
Le roast beef, that's right. In fact, I used this phrase the other day when I was in France. When somebody asked me where I was from, I said, oh, je suis un roast beef.
And does it still translate?
They still get it. Yeah. They still get it. And, of course, I'm posing because I'm actually a Dane, but I thought, well, they'll understand that. It's quite interesting. For a long time in the 19th, even in the 20th century, I had people saying, oh, Gin Lane, Beer Street, you know, Hogarth is showing the appalling times. But actually, no, he's showing the good times and the bad times. And beer is good time. And we shouldn't forget that drinking water in London was a bit of a bad idea, which is why drinking tea was such a good thing, or coffee, anything that where water had to be boiled. And if you were an apprentice, what did you have for breakfast? You didn't drink water, for heaven's sake, not unless you were crazy. You drank small beer. Mm. A small beer was a sensible thing to do. And you would become... So beer and health were well-known bringers of health.
Yeah, and I think it's the contrast, because they're both English products. You can create gin and you can create beer using, you know, English grains, but one is so much more dangerous than the other. And it's not a case of lesser of two evils. This is a wholesome and industrious scene. This is something that he thinks is a good thing. And Hogarth actually brings about change, doesn't he? Because almost immediately after these prints are released, there is the Gin Act, which does start to address this problem, doesn't it?
There have actually, through the mid-18th century, there have been a number of attempts to restrict the distilling and the distribution of gin. And the Gin Act that you're referring to, I think, is the last one in a series of three. Mm. And they basically are putting restrictions on the distilling of gin.
Yeah.
And its distribution, and they're trying to price it out of the market. There's a far more complicated thing going on underneath here. It's probably too complicated to get into in detail. Is the whole nature of corn and the corn laws, and what do you do with the harvest? I mean, I think Hogarth's attitude would have been that it is immoral to grow grain and to turn it into a lethal drug. And I think that's a reasonably sound state of mind to be in.
But also he sees the implications of that, doesn't he? Working in the Foundlings, working in Bedlam. Oh. And actually, that's what his sequential art shows, this series of issues that come from root problems like what happens to corn and when it gets turned into gin. He does seem to have that longer sense, but he is very much focused on the issues of London, isn't he? He's a Londoner through and through, born and raised.
Yes, he is the Charles Dickens of the 18th century in so many senses. And it's interesting, rather like Charles Dickens, you know, there is constantly this slight ambivalence. To what extent is he coining it out of being a commentator? And to what extent is he a genuine agitator, a genuine wanting to do good journalist? And I think the answer is far more than Dickens, actually, that he really does want to do good. I mean, you know, the biggest series of all that he did aimed at the poor workers was the series The Industrious and The Idle Apprentice, the two weavers who start off in the same, under the same master, one of whom is just downright idle, and the other one, Francis Goodchild, is the keenie.
Yeah, he wasn't great on names. They're very literal, aren't they? His
actually,
names.
At the Foundling Hospital, they actually use the name Francis Goodchild for naming one of the children.
There you go.
So you know, this is a big project, and Hogarth actually releases it, rather like Gin Lane, I guess. He releases it in an expensive and in an inexpensive format. So he's actually aware that some of these are unaffordable to to some of the apprentices. And he does the same with the four stages of cruelty. Mm. Not only that, but in the four stages of cruelty, that's a really, really visceral, quite literally visceral series.
Yes, it's all about entrails at the end, isn't it?
It is, the dog devouring the entrails of a felon who's been hanged and is being anatomized before the gawping public. And the dog dips its snout into the offal bucket.
I mean, this is the thing, Hogarth does satisfy our sort of desire for the gritty and the grim. I mean, I find some of his prints incredibly grim. But at the same time, they are remarkable historical documents. I don't think anything brings 18th century London to life like a Hogarth.
No, and I think you have to throw into this mix the fact that, you know, he did well over 200 wonderful portraits of the people of these times. And, you know, that we're not just talking about someone who's sort of snarling in his attic. He was a man of the society. He was undoubtedly the most famous artist of the 1740s. It's only as you move towards the end of his life, when the Rococo is sort of petering out and is giving way to neoclassicism, when the posh people who've made all their money in sugar and slavery are now titled and are now wanting to pull up the drawbridge behind them, it's then Hogarth is beginning to lose traction on his market. He's being criticised by various people. He makes enemies of people. So that towards the end, he's not the fashionable man about town, artist about town that he had been.
But he has a great run, doesn't he? And he was so well known. His art is reproduced. You've been showing me pots and porcelain and you know, this idea that his images were hitting so many people. They were the most fashionable things of the time.
And not only in this country. I mean, from the very outset, the Harlot's Progress goes over to continental Europe. It goes into the great Kupferstichsammlungen of Germany and Holland. If you were a German prince, you would certainly want the latest Hogarth. And they go as far as China. Some of the Hogarth subjects that I found on Chinese porcelain, that for that to happen, the print has to be consciously commissioned in London to go on a ship via Rio de Janeiro, under Africa, all the way up into Canton, then taken cross-country up to Jingdezhen, then painted on a punch bowl, let's say, then taken back to Canton and all the way back into London, because there are clients in London who are so keen on these images. They want them on bowls or on plates or whatever.
Amazing. I mean, that is international reach, isn't it? Yeah. He's an international celebrity in the 18th century. Absolutely. He is remarkable. Lars, we could talk all day. We've already talked a lot. There's even more to say about these prints, isn't there? About how they're made, the etching technique, all the skills that Hogarth brought to that. And, you know, we could carry on. We'll have to get together again and do some more. But what a pleasure. I love talking to you. And I'm looking forward to all the exciting things. You're off adventuring east soon, aren't
you? Well, I'm going off to Penang next week to tell them all about the China trade. And I shall be standing on the shore watching the ghosts of these ships bringing Hogarthian images up to Canton and coming back with punch bowls with the midnight modern conversation.
Oh, what a lovely way to leave it. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to History Hit for being behind this podcast series. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Janine Ramirez. And you can follow me on Facebook as well. There'll be many more to come. Lots more investigations into artworks. But for today, thank you so much, Lars Tharp.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.